Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, if you're like me, sitting in an environment where the flowers are blooming, cherry blossom trees just greet the eye and are a feast for the heart and spirit because it's spring. Well, my guest today, Colleen Plimpton, is a woman that decided to take the love of the garden, the love of nature, and put it into a wonderful, wonderful book called Mentors in the Garden of Life. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Now, Colleen, you never thought in your life that you were going to be a full-time gardener, but that's what you ended up doing. You ended up getting involved in gardening, and because of that, you have done a lot of lecturing, a lot of educating. You have got your own one-acre ornamental garden, a full acre. That is a lot to take care of. I know, because I had a friend that had a garden that was a half an acre, and she was amazed. She said, when I retired, I had no idea how many hours I'd already put into this garden. She'd had it for years. It was just spectacular. And it just took so much of her time. She said, I'm up early in the morning on all day and evening, and she said, I don't know how I managed it before I retired, but I did. She said, I just don't know how I did it.
It's a labor of love.
Now, you trained. Now, I said you never thought, and I don't think you ever dreamed that you were going to be involved in gardening to the degree that you are, but you actually did go to the New York Botanical Gardens, and you were trained there. Tell us about that. Tell us how you got involved with that, and what made you think that that was a good place for you to begin?
Well, I decided that I really wanted to professionalize my gardening knowledge. I'd always been an amateur, always been involved in gardening wherever I lived. And as I got older, I wanted to know more about soil science and pruning and composition and color. And I knew I had to take some courses. So fortunately, I am within driving distance of the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx, and I just started picking up classes there, and I learned so much. And of course, just being at that wonderful place, I was able to see so many beautiful trees and flowers and shrubs and communicate with people much more knowledgeable than I.
Well, I have some friends that are master gardeners, and they just love these classes. And they, like you, have this phenomenal array of plants. They're here in the Pacific Northwest, and the plants are very different in each locale. And one of the things that they were thrilled to learn, because they live on a lake, is what to cultivate that's going to fit in with the environment that they're in, because you don't want to kill yourself doing a garden. And they had some pretty interesting lessons where they said it just wasn't worth cultivating, in their mind's view, certain things because of their environment that they were in and the kind of weather that we get. I mean, we get rain, snow, hail. We get all kinds of cute things that hit us here in the Pacific Northwest, as I'm sure you do in Connecticut, and extreme temperatures sometimes.
Indeed.
But it is, yeah, and we often get so much rain. We've had neighbors who've had elements in their gardens where they actually died because of the amount of rain.
Too much.
Got, which, yeah, just too much, and maybe in abundant amounts. This is something, when you're learning how to work in a garden, it's something you don't rush. It's something that you have to be willing to be the student, because nature's always teaching you, isn't it?
That is true. And that is one of the wonderful experiences of accumulating years of knowledge, season upon season. We learn every year, because every year is a little bit different. But I think the emphasis nowadays that you hear gardeners talk about growing native material indigenous to whatever area we live in is wise, because those are plants that have evolved with the climate, with the climate vagaries. They've evolved with the critters that we find in our gardens. And those plants are going to be hardier than something that's imported from a great distance away.
Mm-hmm. That is very true. And here we have our rhodies and our azaleas, and we've got so many other forms of plants just like you've got. But you have a member of your family that had a tremendous impact on you, and your book, Mentors in the Garden of Life. What I really enjoyed about what you did with this book is, number one, you talked about real people that had an influence on you, like your Aunt Louise. And then you talked about how in being involved in gardening, there were so many various levels of growth and development you had as a person. And in addition to that, you include information on various plants, like the beautiful lilac, and tell the zone that you can grow it in, and what they like, and how they can get to be 20 feet. It's drought tolerant. And, you know, all of this, it's just fascinating information. You can tell how to prune and when to prune.
Yes.
Tell us about your Aunt Louise.
Oh, my great Aunt Louise was a lovely lady who never had children of her own, but she helped to raise my father. My father grew up in the 1920s and 30s in an abusive situation in rural New York State, and my aunt really took him under her wing and raised him as best she could. When he went off to serve in World War II, she was finally free of her child-rearing responsibilities, and then she married. She married a farmer. And as a child, I remember spending wonderful Sunday afternoons and summer vacations at her dairy farm, and I learned so much from her. My parents were not really gardeners, but Aunt Louise was. And to this day, I fondly recall her garden, the chickens, the view from the garden down to the Bristol Hills. It's calming, it's soothing, and she lives on in my memory because of that.
You've mentioned so many interesting people. One is Arthur Kennett.
Yes.
And he called you Squirt.
Yes.
And
did.
That's the personal touch that you have in these real life stories that I just think it's just absolutely wonderful. But he was a person that really had an empathy for nature.
Yes, he did.
He also was a World War II veteran.
Yes.
Tell us about Art.
Uncle Arthur died way too young. He came home from World War II, and he married and started a family, and he developed what probably is colorectal cancer, but you know, people didn't talk about those things back then. And it was clear that he was seriously ill, dying, in fact. And he came home to the farmhouse that he had been raised in, which was where my family was living at the time. And he spent the last 3 months of his life on the sun porch out in back of our big old ramshackle farmhouse. And what he taught me in that last summer of his life, he taught me to really look at the backyard, to look at that yellow blooming rose that his mother, my grandmother, had planted. And he taught me to look at the elm tree where the swing hung that his father had built out of a slab of wood and some chain, and the swing that my brothers and sisters and I swung on. But he really taught me, and I have never forgotten in the 60 years that have passed, I've never forgotten that everywhere I live, there's something beautiful to see if I but open my eyes.
That's quite a special story, a very special story. Another one that I really enjoyed, and again, for those of you listening, we're talking with Colleen Plimpton, and this is spring. This is the time of the year when, if you're smart, I don't care if there's a chill in the air, I don't care if you suddenly get a snowstorm, go out and walk around because Mother Nature is absolutely putting on the best, and she's just busting her color buttons with all of the blooms that are coming out and the greens and the different shades. It's wonderful. It's exciting. It's very inspiring, I think. You had a grandpa that you wrote about. And I loved it because it reminded me of my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Although your experience, my granddad had a real, real deep voice, and he was over 6 feet in height. And, of course, I was just a little short thing. And he just had this way. He'd look at you, and when he went, that was, you know, it was deep. And you felt it in your tummy. You knew you were in deep trouble.
Yes.
But your granddad, I just loved him. The way that you described him. And you were out in the orchard, in an apple orchard. and he caught you guys. Tell us what he did and why that experience was so significant.
Oh, my goodness. A lesson I never forgot was how to appreciate how to treat a tree. The farm that we lived on had some big, old, gnarled apple trees. It had indeed been an orchard at one time, and the trees had been let go, but the apple trees were huge, and of course their fruit was wormy and green, but we loved it, and we loved the tree. My cousins and I, my siblings and I, would find our own little homes. We'd declare a branch of the tree to be ours, and so we each established our little territory in this big, old, rambling apple tree. But in order to mark our turf, what we decided to do, as unknowing and really uncaring children, we decided to peel some of the bark off of each branch so that we could have no trespassers onto our branch. Well, my grandfather, when he saw what we were doing, he told us exactly what we should not be doing. And in his stern but loving way, he taught us a lesson about how to appreciate trees that I have never forgotten.
That is so, excuse me, so important. Just a moment. Sorry, I got something in my throat there for just a minute. It's so important, I think, for children to understand that nature is something you can be hands-on with. And you want them out in the garden with you. You want them digging. But you also want them to understand that they have to respect nature.
Absolutely.
And I think your granddad taught you a fabulous lesson.
Indeed, he did.
Fabulous lesson. Because one of the things we're dealing with today, people are talking about carbon dioxide. Well, trees love them.
Mm-hmm.
And we need more trees.
Mm-hmm.
We really do. There's been mass cutting away of trees. Here in the state of Washington, they have a very strong replanting program that goes into place. And the company Weyerhaeuser has done a great deal towards making sure that we still have the abundance, but population growth and development, the next thing you know, they're all gone.
Yes, that's true.
So unless people plant, unless you know what to plant in your area, unless you know how to allow for the size of the tree as it will grow, and if you're to prune it or not prune it, and these are a couple of things that you cover in your book. Like I said, you have so many different points of information. What's your favorite tree, or is there one?
Oh, I suppose currently probably my favorite tree is the white pine. We have an abundance of them here on the East Coast, and they're very important. They're native, and so they're host and home to many, many birds and insects and important critters. They produce pine cones, which feed other critters like wild turkeys. But, you know, in colonial days, the white pine was extremely important because it grows very tall and straight, and it was a good cash crop for the early farmers. The British people actually built special ships to take these long, tall trunks of white pines back to England for the shipbuilding industry. So not only was it a cash crop, but it's a beautiful tree, and now it's ever more important for our forests as we lose trees to things like disease and, as you say, to development. We need to cherish our trees.
We really do, because they have a tremendous impact on the environment. And I can tell you, we have a part of our home that before the tree that we planted grew to the size that it is right now, my goodness, we were just miserable during the summer. You couldn't be in the room. It just got too hot. And it's a deciduous tree, so the leaves drop in the fall. But, oh, during the summer, it's wonderfully cool, very pleasant. And that's something I think that when you're planting a tree, it is really a good idea to talk to some people that understand the environment that you're planting the tree in.
Absolutely.
Because these trees, the one we planted, holy Moses, that is the biggest tree now. And if we didn't have it pruned every once in a while, whoa, it would have a canopy that would be just, well, it could almost cover all of our front yard property. I mean, it's that big. And it's put on the side of the house. Well, knowing what we know now, we would never do that with a tree. You want to make sure that that tree is put in a place where it can expand its canopy and do what it needs to do, but you don't want to have to worry about pipes and things like this being taken over by the trees. So there's a lot of thought that has to go into it. You mention, and this is a real cute chapter that you have, and it's on compost. And you talk about, well, actually, you mention Mr. Rodale, who is gone now. And he passed away a few years ago, but he really loved working with compost, and he just, he talked about this years and years and years ago, I guess, and was really big on helping people to understand how to do this.
That's
right. So you're
right.
Not into it.
The principles of organic gardening, and it always resonated with me, maybe because I grew up in the country at a time when we, our particular family, didn't use a lot of chemicals on the lawn and in the garden, but I've always prided myself on being an organic gardener and having a healthy ecosystem, not just for me and my family, but also for the critters that live in the woods and in the yard. And so I don't use chemicals. I do use compost. I compost almost everything. I compost the dryer lint. I compost the shredded
really?
Paper. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Dryer
okay,
lint.
So, all right. Now, let's talk about this, because there's a lot of people that are listening. Some of them are going to be in apartments. Some of them are going to be in their own homes, and they go, all right, I just throw everything into the compost pile. But that's not the case, because you mentioned clearly there are different composts, and you don't mix everything in the compost. What is it that you do? Do you have two separate piles of compost? How do you handle it?
Usually I have two separate piles. One pile is where I throw things in, everything from my paper coffee cup, from the local coffee shop, and the coffee grounds, of course. And that's the working pile. That's the pile that's heating up, and those little soil microorganisms are going to work making black dirt. Oh, man, what a process. It's like a miracle that it happens. And the other pile is the done pile, and that's what I pull from. Every single thing I plant gets planted in a mixture of earth and compost. So there's never enough compost, even though I keep on making it.
Well, now, I'm just curious about something, because I had someone tell me once about compost that you don't mix food in with your branches and your leaves. You have this mixture over here, and then you have something else for food. Do you add worms? Do you go out and get, let's say, you know, a bucket of worms to toss in there? Do you have it in a container? Do you just put it on the ground? What do you do with your compost?
I just put it on the ground. Mother Nature's been composting for millennia. She knows how to do it. It just happens, and compost just happens. So when I start a compost pile, I'll take some of the fallen leaves, and I'll take my kitchen scraps. All of my kitchen scraps go in there except meat and bones. I put in the leftover peanut butter and jelly sandwiches that the grandkids don't eat. I put in the soggy cereal. I put in the eggshells. It all goes in the compost. And then I'll put in some coffee grounds that I get from my local funky coffee shop. And I'll put in some twigs. And I'll put in various things, as I said, like shredded paper, vegetable leavings from the garden, clippings from the ornamental garden. It all goes in the pile. And compost happens. The worms come by themselves. The other soil microorganisms come up from the earth, which is why I believe in composting in contact with Mother Earth, piles on the ground.
Now, what about smells? What about flies?
Doesn't smell, no flies. The thing is,
really?
Really, mm-hmm. If it begins to smell, my compost piles never do, because mine are active compost piles, and the decomposition process happens very rapidly. If it should begin to smell, and when I teach composting, I tell my students this, get a pitchfork and turn it a little bit. Incorporate some air into it. And flies, I've never had flies attracted to the compost pile, but this is because whenever I put in the kitchen scraps, I make sure that I dig a little hole in the compost pile and bury them. And so there's nothing for the flies to get at.
Okay. Now, these compost piles get pretty hot.
They do. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes. I had to chuckle when you said you lug home 40 pounds of 40-gallon bags of shredded paper. A recycling plant would be very unhappy if everybody did that with their paper. Recycling. But you know what? If someone had the space and old pizza boxes, anything
yes.
like that. You
yes.
made a comment about shredding them, and that, I think, makes a big difference, because
mm-hmm.
that will enable it to break down. And newspapers, I know, have always been good for compost. Or are
sure.
they?
Oh, yes, they are. But I recycle all my newspapers. When I'm starting a new garden bed, however, that's when I stockpile my newspapers, and I will just lay them right on the turf, the grass, wherever I'm wanting to build a new garden bed. So I just mow that lawn short, I pile on the pizza boxes, the newspapers, and then on top of that, I'll put mulch, I'll put compost, I'll put shredded leaves, and that way it just turns into a beautiful, moist earth garden bed, and I don't have to dig it.
Oh, for heaven's sake. I loved what you said here. You said, with compost piles, it's just like kids. They have to have nourishing food, like grass clippings, kitchen waste, brown material like leaves and twigs. It takes discipline. When they're rowdy and outgrow their boundaries, you find useful things for them to do, like become potting soil or garden mulch or an additive to a planting hole. And if they're not thriving, the compost isn't thriving, you like to take their temperature, which I chuckled at that, and you want to diagnose their issues. You say sometimes they need more fiber, you feed them pine cones. Sometimes the compost pile is thirsty, you give it water. When it's hungry, you add nitrogen. And sometimes they don't have enough friends, so then you add whatever's necessary, worms, insects, or what have you. And you also throw in a little horse manure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Now, Colleen, with the book, you have so many special stories. How long did it take you to compile all of these wonderful stories about the people that have had such an influence on you?
Well, the thing is, several of the stories had already been published in essay form or in my garden column, and when I set out to make it a book, I set myself a goal. I said, I'm going to write a chapter a week, and I did. And there's, 36 chapters or so. So it took the better part of a year, what with the editing and everything. But I find that I work best when I have deadlines, and of course editors and copy editors and all those have deadlines as well. But I just knew that this needed to be a book. There was nothing else like it around. And I do find that it resonates particularly with women, with midlife women gardeners, because we all have stories. We all are attached somehow to various plants in our gardens. Either they've been given to us by someone, or we've given a portion of them to someone else, or we remember them from our childhood, like Lily of the Valley and roses. And I just felt that those stories needed to be written down, or they would be lost. So mm-hmm. I accomplished what I set out to do, and I find that, for instance, yesterday I did a book reading at our local independent bookstore, and a woman came up to me, and she said, you know, you put me in touch with my childhood. She said, I grew up on a farm, and I worked so hard on that farm that for a long time I couldn't think of anything happy about the experience. But she said, you brought back the happy memories, and that's great.
That is a very special acknowledgement, and it's
a
wonderful thing that you were able to touch that woman in that way. I want to talk a little bit about your personal life, because you bring that up in the book. You have a chapter called Pansy, Muriel Ridener. And this is a woman I really enjoyed reading about her, because you said there was nothing organized about her garden. It was so happenstance and so weird, and if you'd look at it, you'd say, oh, this is terrible. But somehow or another, it all came together. But you were diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. You had to go through surgery,
mm-hmm.
and fortunately you didn't have to go through chemo. But this was a very, very special experience that you shared with Muriel. Talk about that chapter.
We were very close when we worked together for the state of Connecticut. And although we, at first glance, we had nothing in common, we carpooled together. We found each other through an 800 number, you know, meet your prospective carpool person. And so we started riding to work together, and we found we had so much in common. And we read poetry to each other, and we told jokes about people that we knew, and then we began to talk about plants and gardening. And even though she's a very different gardener than I, because she really does garden with abandonment, and I don't. I'm a little more disciplined. Not much, but a little bit. And gosh, we found common ground, as it were, over the garden. And I realized that some of the things that I cared too much about, like what should grow where, didn't matter, because she would grow things in the gosh darndest places, and they would thrive. So
mm-hmm.
What she taught me was that one doesn't need to be neat as a pin. One doesn't need to grow a particular plant in a particular place. That, hey, try it someplace else. It might just do well. So she kind of helped me to step out of myself and enjoy things in a very different way. And isn't that what good friendship is all about anyway?
Oh, I think so. I think that's the joy of the friendship, mm-hmm. is the uniqueness of each individual, mm-hmm. and what they bring in their uniqueness into the friendship. I want to talk about the pansy for a little bit, because you have a wild pansy, and there's photos throughout your book of different species of plants, trees. And this is called a Viola tricolor, and it's a wildflower. And you say if you want to consume it, because people grow these so that they can be put in salads, and I've had some salads with pansies in it, and it sort of takes you aback, because if you're not accustomed to including flower petals in a salad, it sort of, you go, okay, let's see how this goes. But one of the points that you bring out is that if you're going to raise this particular type of pansy, because it is edible, then you want to be sure you don't use any chemical fertilizers of any kind, because you're going to be eating it. You don't want to ingest that. Now, you said the bugs of the world, the slugs and deer, just love it. And we have deer out where we are. And, of course, they're foraging for food, and so this tastes good. I mean, if we like the petals, they're going to like them as well.
Mm-hmm.
You say use non-toxic controls. What would you recommend? Because here in the Pacific Northwest, slugs are very common, and I have a very good friend who is a marvelous gardener, and she said she's very upset with herself because she put out typical slug bait, and here in the Pacific Northwest, we have what we call banana slugs, and because of population development, they're disappearing, and her husband is a bug specialist, so she said, oh my goodness, I don't want to kill them, so I can't use that anymore, but she said, I just don't know what to do, what to use for slugs, because she wants to get rid of the other ones that are you know, gazillions of those, and they're prolific. They breed very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you recommend for, you know, getting rid of slugs where you don't have to use toxic chemicals?
One of the things that I like to use is copper collars. Slugs will not go anywhere near copper because it gives them a slight electrical charge. So,
really?
Isn't that interesting? So what I did, I went to a big box store and bought some copper flashing and got a heavy-duty pair of scissors and cut it into little strips. And so I now put sensitive plants that are sensitive to slugs, mm-hmm. I ring that with the little copper collar, and the slugs stay away. It's not toxic. It's not. They just know that they don't want to be anywhere near that.
Amazing. I've never heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of the beer in a can, but I haven't heard of a copper collar. That's amazing.
Yeah,
then if you grow the pansies, the way to prepare them for a salad, you coat them with sugar, and you can also press them and put them into art form as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They're quite charming, little violas. They're popping up all over my yard now, and some of them here bloomed in January because we had such a mild winter. But they're sprightly and they're pretty and they have pretty little names like Heart's Ease and they're just pretty little plants and they self-sow, so they'll come back next year and I recognize the little seedlings, so I'll let them go for next year's crop.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, you have won awards. This book has been so well received and I know what a joy it is because I've read the book. And it's just so refreshing, and this is a time of the year when people really, here in the Pacific Northwest, when the sun shines, everybody goes bonkers. I mean, nobody wants to talk to anybody else. If they are, they're outside. They're in their gardens because we've had such wacky, crazy weather and so much rain. So when the sun comes, we just get, you know, really weird here in the Pacific Northwest. And we've had a couple of days of this. Where can people go to find out more about the wonderful publication that you have put out, Mentors in the Garden of Life, and also any other information you have about gardening?
Well, my website has a plethora of information. It also has information about my book. My website is simply www.colleenplimpton.com. It has my blog and my garden column. I write a column for Hearst about twice a month, and that is always there with lots of garden tips. And there's information on how to purchase the book. The book is also available in independent bookstores and, of course, on Amazon. And on my website, I would be happy to send along an autographed copy. But in terms of general information about gardening, I think some of the national publications are wonderful, like Fine Gardening, which covers the whole spectrum of what to grow. But also I think that one of the best ways to learn about gardening is to visit other people's gardens. Go on the tours, go visit friends' gardens, exchange plants, go to the garden clubs, plant sales and open houses, and that way you see what grows in your neighbor's garden, and you know it'll probably grow in yours.
Colleen, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Check out our website, Colleen Plimpton, that's C-O-L-L-E-E-N, P like Paul, L-I-M like Mary, P like Paul, T-O-N. com. I wish you the best. It's been absolutely a delight having you as a guest. And for those of you that have problems with slugs, hey, use those copper collars. Cool idea. Donna Sebo here. We are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. We have another guest scheduled for today, and we're trying to reach him at this time. Mr. T.B. Fisher, Lessons Learned by Established Hippies and Withered Flower Children. The book is titled Brought In, a little bit of wisdom that he was going to be sharing. But if we're not able to reach him, we're still going to go forward. Open lines, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, here in the Pacific Northwest, we're just positively giddy because the sun is out, and I was joking about that, but I'm serious. Here in the Pacific Northwest, if you ever have a seminar or anything planned and the sun shines, nobody's going to show up because everybody goes out. When it's raining, everybody shows up, but when the sun's out, no one's going to show up. It's just one of those facts of life of dealing in the Pacific Northwest. I do want to let those of you who are listening in New York and Alaska, I'm going to be in New York City Friday and Saturday of this week. So if you'd like to meet with me or to make contact for any other reason, 253-582-5604 is my office number. And then I'm going to be in Anchorage and Fairbanks, Alaska. And all the information is on my website. I'll be there from the 2nd of May through the 7th. So I'm really looking forward to both trips, and I understand that it snowed in New York today. So, and I talked with someone, and they said, well, be prepared. It's going to be chilly. Well, that's just the way Mother Nature is. We had it snow here in May one year. In May. Absolutely astonished me. It's the first time I ever saw corn snow. Corn snow is just these little round pellets of snow. And we had it for maybe a day, and I had a friend that called me that she and her husband were driving up from California. Well, in California, obviously, it's nice and warm. They don't have corn snow there. So she wanted to know how to dress. Well, I was freezing, and I was from California myself, and I said, oh, the temperatures are down. We've had 30-degree temps at night. And so she and her husband drive up. Now, this was about a week after I'd talked to her. She gets out of the vehicle when they come into the driveway, and she gets out of the vehicle and she says to me, "I want to know what happened to the snow." She was dry, just absolutely miserable because she had not brought warm weather clothing. She had cool weather clothing. I said, "Well, I, you know, can't control Mother Nature," so we always chuckle about that one. She said, "Yeah, so much for your cold temperatures in the Pacific Northwest." Would you believe that a turkey could terrorize a community? Well, I've got news for you. In Woburn, Massachusetts in 2005, that is exactly what was going on. A wild 20-pound turkey absolutely was one with an attitude and terrified the community of Woburn, Massachusetts. People didn't want to leave their homes, and every time the police tried to catch it, if they did catch it, it always go back to the neighborhood. So somebody must not have been very nice to that turkey. And then something about birds. Don't ever underestimate the creatures in nature. Starlings, which we have here in the Pacific Northwest, they're in so many places. Well, they are on both sides of the U.S. and I think everywhere in between. These are incredibly intelligent birds. And lots of times they build where you don't want them to build. Well, there was a car wash manager in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and he couldn't figure out what was going on with a car wash coin machine. The quarters were disappearing. So he had a video camera put on it and did his due diligence with starlings. They had figured out how to get in the machine and steal the quarters. They love shiny things. And so they were stealing his quarters. Don't you just love it? Absolutely love it. And then, last but not least, a chipmunk. Do you know that one year there was a chipmunk that got trapped in a woman's car while she was camping? She was in Utah. That chipmunk, nobody knew it was there. Followed it, was with her, not by choice, but was in her vehicle all the way back to California and survived that trip without food or water. New chipmunk population popping up in places you would never have imagined. Donna Sebo here, just a little bit of trivia. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat today, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. This week we've got a wonderful lineup of guests. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about dreamed up reality. Bernardo Kastrup is going to be talking to us about abilities of the mind and how to use them. Also, we're going to be talking with Lou Paradise. We're going to be talking about the effects of various medications and what we can do if we're wanting to work with some legislative changes regarding pharmaceuticals and other things. So we're going to be talking about that. And then I'm going to be traveling to New York City. So on Thursday, we're going to be having the Best of Donna. And then on Friday, from the Big Apple, I'll be interviewing Gregory Crouch on China's Wings. That's the book. This is an absolutely amazing book regarding history that once I started reviewing it, it was very difficult for me to put it down. And it is so replete with history. And it's about America, the airline industry, just when it was beginning to really come together, and our interaction with the Chinese and their particular airline. Fascinating history, and I think you'll find it very, very interesting. So that's the lineup that we have this week. So I hope that you will join me. Well, let's see. I think I'm going to be able to share a good recipe with you. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and again, if you wanted to give me a buzz, the number to call into is 888-627-6008. Credit. There are a lot of people that go through very, very difficult times. Whether you're single, whether you're married, it's not fun when your credit goes into the skids. It just is not a pleasurable experience. And many, many times you wonder, how in the world can you rebuild credit when you've had a bankruptcy or there may be some other extenuating circumstances that go on? Maybe your credit score, because of one thing or another, has gone in the wrong direction. Well, if you want to prove that you really are a good credit risk, of course, paying bills on time is about 35% of your credit score. And you just need to show that you make prompt payments, and you can make small purchases with a credit card and pay it off every month. I know of a young couple. The couple had just gotten married, and the husband had experienced a bankruptcy prior to the marriage. Now, the wife had had excellent credit. The husband didn't. They were interested in buying a brand new vehicle. And what occurred was, is they went in and nobody was going to touch them because the husband had a lousy credit record. Well, they went into a particular bank, and this happened to be in the state of California. They went around the different banks, and a lot of banks just turned them down. They wouldn't even talk to them. If you mentioned that you had had a bankruptcy, that was it. Don't call me for 7 years, 14 years, whatever it was at the time. And so what occurred is they finally went into a bank and sat down with someone. And this was a woman who was an executive at the bank, and they were talking with her, and she said, if you really want to get your credit back, what I want you to do is I want you to bring in all of the information about your bankruptcy. And she said, then let's talk. So that's what the couple did. The wife gathered all the information. They go into the bank, talk with this person. This woman said, if you will make arrangements with these people to pay back your debt and show us that the arrangement has been made and you work on this for a year, then come back and talk to me. If you take care of certain things, we then will guarantee the loan. They couldn't believe their luck. Everybody else had turned away from them. So she gave him another point of information. She said, go out and buy something that you can put on layaway and make payments on that, and then come back and talk to me again. So the wife worked out all of the information about how much payment they would make. They sat down and agreed that they couldn't do anything extra for 1 year, and they could clear the amount that was due on the husband's bankruptcy. They did that. They also went out and they bought a couch, put it on layaway, made payments, and the company said, oh, take the couch. You just make payments to us on a regular basis, which they did. 1 year later, this couple goes back into the bank, talks to this executive officer, and they had had to show all the payments and everything else. All the creditors were cleared. And she said to them that in all the years she'd been in banking, she'd never known a couple ever to come in willing to work with these kinds of options and actually do it. Do you know that couple found out later their total bankruptcy situation, or the husband's bankruptcy situation, was totally erased? There was not a record of a bankruptcy at all. They had paid off all of the credit companies and had bought that one piece of furniture showing that they were responsible. The new car they wanted to purchase, the executive at this bank said, we will guarantee that loan. We will be happy to back you up because you have gone that extra mile. So this is something you can remember. I share that story with you because it's important for you to understand. There are always people that are willing to work with you. And if you're committed and you really want to have a good credit score, and you've gone through some tough times, this young couple did it. This young couple, they paid their bill. It was tough. They didn't even have a dollar extra a month. It wasn't fun. But they did it. And they got that brand new car. It was an amazing story that they shared. So I share it with you because you need to know what worked for somebody else can work for you. So don't ever give up on that. And just remember, take care of those financial responsibilities. And if it means that you can't go out for dinner or something, that's okay. It's temporary. Just take care of those bills, and the rest will take care of you. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Our guest is not going to be showing up today, but that's okay. Those phone lines are open, and when we come back, I'll have other good stories to share with you. 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008. I had some information on traveling, and in preparing for flights, boy, have I found you've really got to shop around. And there are some pretty good flight deals, but be thoughtful because you need to check with the actual airline that maybe you would prefer to fly with, as well as some of these discount things. You have to find out what's going to work. I found that some of the companies that said they had such good discounts were not such a good deal. Other companies, when you went to them directly, their prices were just as high as some of the discount places, and you have to be willing to shop around. Well, they're finding shopping around is always a good deal. That's nothing new. Any of us that are prudent with a dollar, that's what we're going to do. But what about people that are accustomed to buying their tickets way, way ahead of time? Is that such a good thing to do anymore? There was a study of over 144 million airline purchases for tickets that flyers who buy airline tickets about 6 weeks prior to their departure pay nearly 6% less than those who buy them at any other time. Why? Well, a lot of people assume that the lower price tickets are sold out months in advance, so ticket prices drop sharply as your departure date nears. So the airlines scramble to sell off whatever leftover tickets they have at a bigger discount so they don't end up with empty seats. Well, if you're like me and you can't wait at the last minute, you have to plan. You have to really shop around. That's all I know to tell you. Shop, shop, shop to the best of your ability. And boy, I found some good bargains. And sometimes it's worth paying that little bit of extra if you know the airline that you're flying with has nonstop flights. You don't want to be laid over in certain communities. It's a good thing to remember, too. So it all depends on what your needs are. It all depends on what your budget is and how you like to time and work with things. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you want to chat. 888-627-6008. I wanted to share a quick recipe with you. If you're like me and you love Mexican food, and many times you want to fix something that's going to be quick, easy, deliciously flavorful, but maybe have a little bit of a different twist to it. I came across a chicken and spinach enchilada. Now, if you're not big on spinach, this may not be something that you'd want to do. But I have an idea. Why don't you try some other vegetable? You might want to try asparagus. So let me give you this basic recipe, and don't be afraid to adapt it in any way that you want. This takes about 20 minutes to fix and piece of cake. You need some nonstick cooking spray, 2 cups of salsa. You can make your own if you have a favorite recipe. Me, I'm just going to get it out of the jars. I have certain preferences. 2 cans of enchilada sauce. if you are a homemaker and you say, I have my own enchilada sauce recipe, great, go for it. You're going to need about 20 ounces of sauce, maybe a little bit more. You need 3/4 cup of low-fat cream cheese. 3/4 cup of low-fat cream cheese, that's about 6 ounces. 1 package, 10 ounces of frozen chopped spinach. You want to let it thaw. And then you want to put it in a paper towel or a regular towel, whichever you prefer, and then you want to squeeze that water out of it. You want that spinach to really be as free of liquid as possible. You're going to need 2 cups of chopped, cooked chicken. And if you like rotisserie chickens like I do, then just use some of that. It's really a great way to use that chicken meat. And then you're going to need 8 8-inch flour tortillas and a package about 8 ounces of shredded Mexican cheese blend. I would say if you're like me, you want more cheese, add more cheese. Basic recipe. Now you're going to preheat your oven to 350 degrees. Of course, you want to need a 13x9 baking dish, and you want to spray that with cooking spray. You want to put about 1/2 cup of your salsa and enchilada sauce, 1/2 cup of the salsa and 1/2 cup of enchilada sauce in a medium bowl. Just whip it real quickly, and then you're going to put that to the side. You want your cream cheese. You might want to put it in a microwave oven, medium-sized bowl. Heat it for about 1 minute until it's very soft. Or if you're like me, just put it out before you fix the meal. Let it come to room temperature on its own. You're going to take your spinach, your chicken, and the remaining 1 1/2 cups of salsa. You want to add that into the bowl, and you stir it till it's blended. And then each of your tortillas, you take about 1/3 cup, give or take a little, of your chicken mixture. You roll it up. Put your enchilada seam side down in your baking dish, and then when you're finished doing all of that, you have those 8 tortillas. You fill those all up, put them, the enchilada sauce mixture evenly over the tortillas that have been rolled, top them with cheese, and bake until the cheese is melted and bubbly. That's going to take about 30 minutes. And let it rest for about 5 minutes before you serve it. If you're like me, you're going to want a little bit more sauce, and you're also going to want more cheese. And I love cheese. And for this, you might want to have your Mexican spicy cheese. Yep, that might be something that would work very good, too. So it's a recipe that you can play around with. And if you don't like spinach, well, why not use asparagus? Or you could even use kale with this. But you'd have to make sure that, again, that all the moisture was out of it. Anyway, let's go on with a story about finding $45,000. What would you do if you found bags of money, $45,000? And you found them in a house that you bought. Well, that's exactly what happened with Josh Farron. And I've got a picture of the bags of money that he found. He had just purchased a brand new home, and he noticed a scrap of carpet that was sticking out of the ceiling. And it was really weird, so he pulled on it. And all of a sudden, this opening occurred that led into the attic. And he climbed up there, and he saw a metal container. And he said it was a World War II ammo box. He said his grandfather used to have one, and he stored his tools in it. And he opened the box, and he couldn't believe what he saw. He found money tied up in orange twine. That's right. But he found more than one box. He found 7 other boxes in this attic filled to the brim, plus 2 big black trash bags full of cash. When they counted it all, it was $45,000. He said, oh, wow, this is so great. What could we do with all of this money? What would you have done? Well, he couldn't have lived with himself by just taking the money. He said, I had fun with all of my fantasies, but I knew I had to return the money to prior owners. But they were surprised. They didn't know anything about the money. They had inherited the house. And so they put it up on the market. They said it must have been their dad who had hidden the money. But they could not figure out why he did it. And, you know, Josh said, can you imagine the time it took for him to roll the money, tie it with his orange string? He said he found balls of the orange twine still hanging on the wall of the workshop when they had moved into the house. And so he takes that orange twine now and he wraps Christmas presents with his kids with it. But he said, I had to give the gift of radical honesty. And he said, I wanted my kids to know how important it was to do that. A man's inheritance, his kids knew nothing about, discovered by a stranger that bought the house that he had lived in and gave it back to the family. Awesome story. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You at all times and all places have the right of choice. You can have radical honesty, too. It really is a good thing to develop. Have a radically positive, wonderful day. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.